Next is State versus Timothy Canfield. If counsel could please step forward. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Zachary G. Markarian, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for Timothy Canfield.
Raymond M. Brown of Pashman, Stein, Walter Hayden, on behalf of Amicus Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jason Magnin on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Lila B. Leonard for the Attorney General.
Welcome, counsel. Please be seated. As the clerk advised you in writing last week, we're going to ask the parties to focus primarily on the procedural rule that the appellate division has proposed. You are welcome to address the other question, the absence of a passion provocation manslaughter charge, if you like, but you can also rest on your briefs with respect to that. And I want to thank counsel for the state, Mr. Magnin, in particular, for stepping in at the late hour and enabling us to keep this matter
certainly
on the calendar.
Always a pleasure.
Mr. Short, excuse me, Mr. Markarian, looked at the wrong part. And Justice Solomon is participating in this argument as well.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to request 3 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
May it please the court. This court should adopt the appellate division's proposed rule, which properly recognizes what this court has held is a trial court's primary obligation, to see that justice is done and that a jury is instructed properly on the law and on all clearly indicated lesser included offenses, even where at odds with the strategic considerations of counsel, as this court said in State v. Guerin. Trial courts are already required to hold a charge conference on the record and to instruct a jury as to all clearly indicated lesser included offenses. This rule would serve two purposes. It would prompt trial courts to consider an often relevant charge in the case of passion provocation in a self-defense case, and it would facilitate appellate review by having the trial courts make a clear record at that conference as to their reasons for providing that charge or for not providing that charge. Without such a record, as this case demonstrates, appellate courts are left to speculate about a trial court's reasons for not giving a charge when that failure may have merely been an oversight that deprived a defendant and a jury of a clearly indicated charge that could have resulted in a lesser conviction. This case demonstrates the benefits of the appellate division's proposed rule. If the rule was in place here, it would have spurred the trial court to recognize the need to charge the clearly indicated lesser included offense of passion provocation, manslaughter. From start to finish, this was a case about a reaction. The theme of this case was that Mr. Canfield acted in response to KP's months-long pattern of threatening behavior, which was testified to by witness after witness. There was also testimony that on that evening, KP had attacked someone at the house, disregarding the family's instruction that he not come to the property, disregarding the multiple times that the police had been called to the property. And then there was testimony that KP had made a menacing gesture when being told to leave and started to approach Mr. Canfield. One obvious framework for assessing this reactive use of force by Mr. Canfield was self-defense, which was the defense theory in this case. Another obvious framework for assessing a defendant's reactive use of force, which the jury was not given the ability to consider, is passion provocation manslaughter, and that's sometimes discussed as imperfect self-defense. The first footnote to the self-defense model jury charge already provides that passion provocation manslaughter should be charged in almost all cases where self-defense is charged along with aggravated manslaughter and reckless manslaughter. And there's already a prompt to consider passion provocation manslaughter in the model jury charge for murder as well. This makes sense, especially in the self-defense context, because any deviation from strict self-defense principles would make a defendant's force not justified. To be justified, a defendant's use of force has to be no crime at all. It has to be legal use of force. But as the appellate division recognized in this case, there are many cases where a defendant uses deadly force, believing it to be self-defense, and the circumstances are charged with emotion and swiftly evolving. And because of that, there are many cases where a defendant believes themselves to be using self-defense, but they may not qualify. They may use disproportionate force. They may use deadly force before there's an imminent need to do so, or they may have a duty to retreat if they can that they don't consider because they're impassioned in the heat of the moment. And as the appellate division also recognized, both passion provocation manslaughter and self-defense turn on a victim's conduct. And there was no question in this case that the victim's conduct was very central to the heart of the case. The the jury's ultimate resolution of the case against Mr. Canfield was going to turn on their assessment of the conduct of the victim, KP. Although there will likely be a rational basis to charge passion provocation manslaughter if requested in many self-defense cases, that does not mean it would be clearly indicated in every case. As this court has already said, clearly indicated is a higher hurdle than rational basis.
Your colleague for the ACDL does not want this procedural rule.
Yes.
Because they say that it encroaches on defendant's right to determine strategy and make a determination as to whether to request the charge. Obviously, that's a principle that finds its way into the case law in a number of different settings. Why is the ACDL wrong to be opposing the procedural rule?
Well, I think that is actually at odds with the case law in several ways, because this court has said a number of times that regardless of defense counsel strategy or the state strategy, the trial court has the ultimate obligation to make sure the jury is properly charged, and no one's strategy, assumed or even real advantage, can take precedence over the public interest, and that's from this court's decision in State v. Powell.
But what this, as I understand it, what this procedural rule could, and tell me if I'm wrong, could play out as is the trial court giving a charge that's not only not requested but not wanted by the defendant.
Yes, Your Honor. And trial courts have the obligation sometimes to give charges that are not wanted if they're clearly indicated. In this case, it's unclear. You know, once aggravated manslaughter was charged, the all-or-nothing strategy that defense counsel was positing was already gone. So it's not clear that defense counsel would resist the passion provocation charge in this case. There was just a silence on the record about it. So this would prompt a conversation, and maybe in some cases, if defense counsel could persuade the trial court that it's not appropriate to charge passion provocation, and that if the trial court were to rely on that, that could be invited error, and that could not be an appellate issue any further. But that's clearly not what happened here, because it just wasn't discussed.
So does that mean...
Go ahead.
Sorry. Does that mean that if we were to adopt the appellate division's new procedural rule, this would just never be an issue on appeal again? Because the defendant, it would always be a conversation at trial, and defense counsel would either request the charge, in which case the trial court would basically be required to give it under the rational basis standard, or defense counsel would instead oppose the charge. And if the trial court then didn't give the charge because of the opposition, you just referenced that that would be invited error. So there would be no more appellate review of this charge if we were to adopt the procedural rule.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because there would still, the trial court would still retain the responsibility to make the ultimate conclusion. And under State v. Jenkins, only where the trial court is relying on the defense representation and not giving the charge would it be invited error. So if defense counsel said something like, I'm not requesting the charge, I want all or nothing, and the trial court were then to still make a finding that it wasn't clearly indicated, that could still be reviewed on appeal. But it already is the rare case on appeal where that meets the clearly indicated threshold, and I think it would still be an application of that same standard even if this rule was adopted.
Do you agree there would be a strong argument for invited error if counsel said, Judge, I don't want you to give that charge?
Garen talks about valid reasons for a defense counsel to persuade or a trial court to rely on defense counsel's representation if there would be unfair surprise to the party in giving a charge, or if it would potentially inject an issue into the case that wasn't otherwise there. And if defense counsel were to use those type of arguments to prevail upon the trial court to not give the charge and it was relied upon.
There's no surprise here. There's a conversation, I assume, that's taking place pursuant to the procedural rule. And at the end of that, counsel for defendant, supposedly in this hypo, says, I don't want that charge, Judge. Mm-hmm. I don't want a compromise. I don't want that lesser included charge. Does that create a strong argument for invited error?
I still think that the trial court should not defer just to the all or nothing strategy. The trial court should make its own assessment. As this court has said time and again, it has its own obligation as the law's representative to make a determination of whether the charge is clearly indicated. And just the representation of wanting the all or nothing choice, I don't think is something that trial courts should rely on.
I think the question is what happens on appeal?
Mm-hmm.
And I think both the Chief and Justice Wainwright-Apter mentioned this. The appellate issue is maybe not dead, but pretty close.
Let's put ourselves, though, in the shoes of the trial court for a moment, though. on appeal, when we have a clearly indicated argument, we've got luxury of time, we have all these transcripts. The judge has been sitting on the case for perhaps weeks, may not remember everything, may not have, you know, perfect notes about all what's going on. If we impose on the trial judge this extra task where it's not being presented by the lawyers, and expecting the judge to behave like an appellate judge, isn't that an unfair predicament for the judge to be able to think of all of the evidence and whether it does or does not fit the clearly indicated standard?
I think the clearly indicated standard is already appropriately balancing those concerns, because it tells the trial court not to scour the record. Something needs to jump off the page. And I don't think this would elevate that clearly indicated standard any higher than it already is. It would just make the trial court put its reasons on the record so that there could be appellate review of the reasons for the decision instead of just a void where we don't know if this was an oversight or a calculated decision, if anyone had even considered the passion provocation lesser included charge.
And what's the scope of review of those stated reasons?
It would be the clearly indicated standard on appeal.
What's the scope of review in analyzing the judge's rationale? De novo?
It would be de novo review because it is a legal issue still, but we would have that already the threshold of the clearly indicated standard is quite high. And here, you know, just using this case as an example, I don't think it would have been asking the trial court to scour the record in this case. I think if there had been this prompt for the trial court to be thinking about passion provocation manslaughter, it would have been charged, because this was a case that beginning to end, the theme of the case was this was a family who was at a breaking point because of KP's conduct. They had called the police numerous times. He kept showing up. He had had two violent altercations on the family's property.
But was the defendant involved or present for any of those prior altercations?
The testimony was that the defendant was present for the first altercation with his friend Justin that was about a year and a half prior, and then that he heard and came downstairs shortly after the altercation on this evening with Mr. DeFilippis.
So there's a lot of facts in this case. And in the scenario that was previously discussed, if defense counsel objects to the jury charge for passion provocation under the appellate division's new procedural recommended rule, then the trial judge would then use the clearly indicated standard to determine whether to give the charge. And in that instance, wouldn't we be asking the trial judge to scour the record for all these facts with regard to the history between these individuals to determine whether it's clearly indicated? And as Judge Sabatino mentioned, there's a lot of testimony about the history, what happened, what transpired, and what took place. In that instance, isn't the judge then put in the position of having to go back through all of the testimony and try to figure out whether this is clearly indicated when they have a defense attorney who is objecting to that charge?
Especially because the new rule requires the trial judge to make specific findings on the record. And if I'm sitting as that judge in the criminal court, mm-hmm. and I know I have to make specific findings, aren't we doing more than simply not sifting through the evidence? We're actually scouring through all the evidence to make sure that we comply with this new requirement?
I don't believe so. I believe that already there's an obligation to charge clearly indicated lesser included offenses. Not scour the record, but to, you know, the judge has sat through the whole trial, is aware of what the evidence is, and if there has been evidence, and this wasn't just a hint or a suggestion, this was witness after witness in this case of the Doolin family. Every adult member of the family that lived in this home, five people, testified to some of KP's conduct in the lead up to this. And then there was, you know, obviously the theme of this case on the defense side was that Mr. Canfield was being approached by KP wielding a syringe. I don't think this is sifting through the record so much as just the trial court has been there and reflecting on what the facts that the jury is already being asked to consider on the charges given, whether that would support another charge, which is already something our law requires under the clearly indicated standard.
Did Mr. Canfield testify that the victim threatened to use the syringe as a weapon?
He did not verbally threaten to use the syringe, but, you know, he did threaten, you know, even after Mr. Canfield brought out the bow, there was testimony that the victim said, put the bow down and fight me. And obviously Mr. Canfield knew about the previous violent, the penchant for violence of KP, and knew that this was someone who didn't take, you know, the boundaries that the family had set seriously, had broken into the home, had continued to show up after the police were called numerous times. So I don't think there's any need for a verbal trigger if he perceives the syringe being drawn, which he testified that he believed it was a syringe based on the fact that the last time that the police had been called on KP, a syringe was found on his person. Mr. Canfield knew him to be a user of intravenous drugs with syringes, and ultimately a syringe was found on the ground near KP's body. So I think all of this evidence is enough to support, even without a verbal threat, I'm going to use the syringe on you, enough to support his fear.
How far away was he from the defendant at the time that the object came out that he believed was a syringe?
So there was testimony that when he started to approach, he was 30 feet away, which the testimony there was that, Mr. Canfield was on the stand and said about the distance from the defense attorney to himself, and the defense attorney said 30 feet, and Mr. Canfield said, if that. So suggesting even less than that, potentially, and obviously even that distance can be closed in a matter of seconds. So
this all transpired, what we're discussing right now, the portion with the syringe, that all transpired after everyone went back inside except for KP, and your client went back outside with a bow and arrow.
Yes, Your Honor. He did go back outside after they went inside and saw that even after they'd all been imploring him to leave, he was still there. This was late at night. There were children in the home. They knew that he'd broken in on previous occasions, and Mr. Canfield did not feel comfortable just letting him stand outside and potentially break into the home. There also was testimony that he was being implored not to call the police in this instance because this was a complicated situation where Tricia, also had concern for him because they had a child together and she knew that he had warrants and that. So this was a family that was at its breaking point, and Mr. Canfield, to invoke passion provocation, did not have to behave in a justified manner, and perhaps that retrieval of the bow is part of the reason that self-defense was rejected. But for passion provocation, the question is whether he was adequately provoked, whether a person in his shoes would have been provoked by KP's conduct. And at that point, I submit that there was so much testimony as to the provocative conduct that it would constitute adequate provocation.
Can we go back to the procedural rule for a moment?
Yes.
We talked about what happens if counsel says, I don't want it. Clarify for us what you think happens. We reach the end of the charge conference. The judge, independently, if no one else has spoken to the passion provocation charge, the judge raises it then? Does the judge make findings? Does the judge invite argument? How do you envision this unfolds in practice?
I think the parties would state their position on the record, and then the judge would, taking those positions into consideration, apply the clearly indicated standard. Something like that already happened here, where even though both the state and the defense said they didn't want aggravated manslaughter to be charged, the judge explained why he thought that that was clearly indicated in this record.
Suppose defense counsel, instead of objecting, said, judge, I hadn't thought about that. Good idea. Does that then convert the charge, the review, to rational basis instead of clearly indicated?
I think if for whatever reason it were to be suggested and then shot down, but at the time that it was shot down, if defense counsel had taken the position it should be given, I think then it's a rational basis review because it would be requested.
Do any other jurisdictions follow the approach that we're talking about?
I'm not aware of this specific procedure that the appellate division requested being invoked by other jurisdictions.
Ordinarily, when the argument is made for the first time on appeal, the reviewing court looks at the record objectively to see whether the charge is clearly indicated, jumping off the page.
Yes.
Why as a reviewing court do we need a trial judge's findings about the same thing we'll be looking to ourselves on the same record?
Well, what happened here, I think, shows that there's this discomfort with the idea of reversing when there's speculation that the trial court has made a reasoned decision. The appellate division said, rerunning a trial when the charge could have been considered before the jury retreated to consider is not something that is palatable.
It has nothing to do with objectively reviewing the record. It's simply, as I think Justice Wayne Raptor was mentioning earlier, to review a potential reversal. That's the only reason.
Yes.
That's the basis for the rule itself.
I don't think that the rule is required to find it was clearly indicated here, but I think that the fact that this case is the one where this court proposed the rule indicates some discomfort with the fact that there was no conversation on the record here about something that I submit was jumping off the pages of the record. So I think the appellate division wanted these conversations to happen before the jury retreats and considers the evidence so that they are fully charged, which this court has said is something that is the trial court's obligation already as the representative of the law, regardless of the positions of the parties. So I think the appellate division imposed this extra step in the hopes of incentivizing trial courts to take seriously what already is their obligation. I don't think it alters the standard at the trial level or at the appellate level for considering whether something is clearly indicated.
So one last question. So is it your view that the defense counsel chose not to request the passion provocation charge, even though it was clearly indicated, for strategic reasons?
Because we don't have express statements on the record, we don't know ultimately after aggravated manslaughter was injected into the case why he didn't ask for it, but we know initially he was hoping to do this, to put the jury to this all or nothing choice so that they could not compromise and reach a middle ground, but that already had been thwarted by the trial court appropriately applying the clearly indicated standard and finding that reckless manslaughter and aggravated manslaughter were clearly indicated. There was no statement after the trial court found those clearly indicated about a desire not to have any other charges injected. It just seems as though it was an oversight. No one brought up passion provocation manslaughter, even though it frequently travels with self-defense and the other charges that were given.
Counsel, can I just clarify the record and ask you to explain what this passage means?
Sure.
I thought defense counsel, in the conversation about reckless and aggravated manslaughter, said, I don't think it should be included. But for the record, it's my request that no lesser included charges should be filed, should be charged here. And the reason is, Judge, I think it almost invites the jury to compromise. How do you understand that statement?
I understand that defense counsel didn't want to give anything between self-defense acquittal and the murder conviction because they thought the jury would compromise. But the trial court overruled that appropriately by saying that reckless and aggravated manslaughter were clearly indicated.
Yes.
And defense counsel then acquiesced in that and said, the law says you have this obligation.
Does this phrase extend beyond the reckless and aggravated manslaughter context where counsel says no lesser included should be charged? That's my view, Judge.
I think that was his view before reckless and aggravated manslaughter were charged. But then he acquiesced when those were charged and said, yes, you have this duty under the law to charge what you find clearly indicated. And that was the end of that conversation.
One premise of the procedural rule here, and you mentioned it at the beginning of your argument, was a perception that it'd be useful here to have this as a housekeeping item, because too frequently the appellate division or Supreme Court are reversing convictions because this clearly indicated issue was missed. Does the public defender have any data or empirical indication that that perception is true, that this is happening too much?
I don't think it's true that there's been too many reversals. The clearly indicated standard already sets a pretty high bar for reversal. And since Funderburg, I'm not aware of any published opinions reversing murder convictions for failure to charge passion provocation as a clearly indicated.
So is this a solution in search of a problem?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I do think the problem still exists of making sure the trial courts recognize their obligation, which this is court has held many times they do have, to make sure the jury is properly charged regardless of the representations of the parties. So to spur the trial court to recognize that this is a commonly recurring fact pattern.
We don't see most of the cases, obviously, but we see a lot of them in the cert process, and I just have not sensed any trend where the trial courts are dropping the ball on this issue. Am I wrong about that?
Well, respectfully, I think this is a case where the trial court dropped the ball, and I think maybe that discomfort is why the appellate division reached to create this rule here, because it is kind of baffling why this wouldn't have been something that the trial court was spurred to think about, given
maybe
all
the
testimony.
Maybe the trial court thought about it until the lawyer said, I don't want any lesser included. It wasn't just the two that were on the table, but all.
Well, here, didn't the appellate division find that there was nothing jumping off the page, and therefore the trial court was correct not to give the instruction? So they just created the rules so that in a future case, mm-hmm. which you're not aware of, then they wouldn't have to reverse if something was jumping off the page?
Yes, but I think in the way the appellate division applied the finding that there was nothing jumping off the page really was not a faithful application of the clearly indicated standard, as this court has said. It's not to look at the credibility of the witnesses or the worth of the evidence, but the existence of the evidence. And to say, as the appellate division said here, that Mr. Canfield only subjectively perceived this threat, that there wasn't any reason to perceive this threat, I think really read out of the record a wealth of evidence that was testified to about Mr. Canfield's knowledge of KP's violent history, which is not in the appellate division. The appellate division decision, even though witness after witness talks about all the times this family called the police, somehow the appellate division didn't find space for that in its opinion. The appellate division also read out, the history of previous attacks that Mr. Canfield was aware of, which amplified his fear of KP. And the appellate division really took sides, speculating as to how the jury would assess Mr. Canfield's credibility about whether he was in fear. And so I think that was not an appropriate application of the clearly indicated standard. And if a trial court were to apply the standard that way, I don't think that that would be appropriate, because it would create an insurmountable bar to really ever finding that passion provocation is clearly indicated.
But the appellate division obviously thought it was an appropriate application in this case because that was their holding, correct?
Yes.
So they're really just creating this rule so that in the future, in an unnamed case where you said you're not aware of any that have mm-hmm. reversed a conviction on this basis, then there wouldn't need to be a reversal.
Yes, because the trial court would be spurred to be thinking about this issue. But my concern is the appellate division's decision in creating this rule, but then applying it this way here, creates an insurmountable burden where a trial court will never actually think it's clearly indicated to charge passion provocation. Because if these facts, this lengthy, detailed history of KP's harassing conduct, this history of not taking the family's request that he not come to the home seriously, even when the police were called, and a menacing gesture, which has clearly been held to be provocation, if this isn't enough, then I think the clearly indicated standard really doesn't exist anymore, because this whole trial was about provocation. This whole trial was about Mr. Canfield being pushed into conduct that he would not otherwise have taken by KP's actions.
Mr. Canfield went back in the house, and it could mm-hmm. all have been over. Presumably, he would have, maybe the victim would have stayed out of the house and been agitated, but eventually would have left. Everybody locks the doors. Nobody takes a bow and arrow and goes back out. That's an important fact mm-hmm. in support of the trial court's ruling or non-ruling, as the case may be.
There are many cases where there is some interval of time between the initial provocation and the ultimate use of force, and here
not just a rule, not just an interval of time though. He's out there unarmed. This is according to his version of facts. We don't know the victims. He's out there unarmed. He goes back in the house. He gets the bow and arrow, and then he comes out.
Yes, but he was still in the heat of this moment where this person was outside the home, and he had broken in previously. Mr. Canfield knew he had a penchant for violence. Perhaps he should have called the police. Perhaps in many passion provocation cases, an individual should call the police instead of using force, and that's why it is still criminally culpable conduct. It's just conduct that our law recognizes as less culpable because a person has been provoked. So I don't think that in order to find that passion provocation was clearly indicated here, this court needs to say that everything Mr. Canfield did in the course of this event was a good decision or a decision that we should encourage. That would be self-defense, where this was no crime at all. Here, it's still a very serious second-degree crime, but it's one where the law recognizes that a person has been pushed into these circumstances, has been provoked by a victim's conduct.
I believe that the new rule, as written by the appellate division, requires this conversation only when self-defense is mm-hmm. charged. Is it your understanding that that's the rule? Or because from hearing your argument today, it seems like you're saying in any case where passion provocation may be appropriate, even without regard to self-defense being charged, this specific findings that the judge is required to make should apply as well.
I think that the appellate division's role is limited to cases where self-defense charge is charged, and I think that that is appropriate because this court has already recognized in State v. Bowens that imperfect self-defense is another name for, even though it's not independently codified under the criminal code, that can bear on other offenses such as passion provocation. So I think when self-defense is asserted, that should be a prompt in the mind of, well, self-defense comes with all these very high thresholds where you have to only use proportionate force, you have to be responding to an imminent threat of deadly force, and you have a duty to retreat. If any of those are not met, the jury may still think that the defendant was only acting in response to a victim's conduct, but may not think it was justified. And I think, I submit that's what happened here, and the jury just didn't have any outlet for making that finding because they were not given the passion provocation manslaughter charge.
You argued that in this case, the appellate division's application of the clearly indicated standard would do away with the menacing gesture rule. What was the menacing gesture in this case? Did the defendant testify that the victim was holding the syringe up above his head in some sort of way that was preparing to strike him with the syringe?
No, but I think that would ask too much because here the testimony was that there had been a long conversation. There had been a history of telling this person not to come to this home. And then on this evening, this person had already attacked someone unprovoked in the yard. And then he was told to leave time and again. There was a conversation overheard by neighbors who testified at the trial where the family was begging him to leave. And then Mr. Canfield did draw the bow and ask, you know, try to induce KP to leave because nothing else was working. And then the testimony was, he said, put the bow down and fight me. And then he started to approach and took a needle out of his pocket. There was no testimony about, you know, where he held the needle, but it was clear he was advancing on Mr. Canfield and had withdrew a needle.
Withdrawing of the needle or the advancing the menacing gesture?
I think combined with the whole history of, what Mr. Canfield knew about KP's penchant for violence and the withdrawal and the advancing were the menacing gesture.
Other questions, anyone? We'll have you back to the bottom, Mr. Markarian. Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor, and Your Honors. This morning, I feel like a true amicus because I agree and disagree with everybody. I wanted to start, I'd like to reserve just maybe 1 or 2 minutes of my too small amount of time to comment on point one, which is the issue of the ruling in this case, but obviously would like to address most of my comments to the appellate division rule. And I'd like to start with something that I used to abhor as a young lawyer when I was still wet behind the ears, which is some older lawyer would get up and say, you know, I've never seen this before. If you look at the question of a trial judge's ability to sift through the record or do this analysis, it doesn't compare to the appellate division. This is not to suggest that the appellate division is not overworked, overburdened, and underpaid. But it is to suggest that except in the rare case where an accused is wealthy or the state has chosen to allocate significant resources, there is no daily copy. There is no opportunity to look back at the record and make a careful assessment. And I think that's really important because there seemed to me to be, and I respect Judge Sustein as I do other brilliant members of the appellate division, but I do think there is much flavor in this. And I think in some ways it's in derogation both of precedent, stare decisis, and the adversary system, that somehow we should not have the appellate division wrestling with these questions on the question of whether there is clearly indicated evidence of passion provocation, when that's really the best forum. A trial judge in this case, for example, had to deal with questions about where is the curtilage and a whole host of issues besides element analysis. So I think the suggestion that it's inappropriate for the appellate courts to look at these issues, I think back of Justice Jackson's comment about the Supreme Court, you're infallible because you're last, not last because you're infallible. And that is a process that should be done by the appellate division. I think there's a logical flaw also in the trigger here. The analysis here, that the thing I agree with the appellate division about was it did it wrongly, but it did do a fact-based analysis. Here, the trigger is something
separate. It isn't calling on judges who, by the way, if we don't assume that every judge who's charging in a murder case isn't looking at lesser includeds, what are they doing? That's what their job is. And indeed, the form, at least one of the model forms, requires you, your eyes, to go through that list. So I was going to say, Justice Patterson, that this is a solution in search of a problem, but I said that would be deemed disrespectful coming from me. But now that it's been said by Your Honor, I feel...
I guess it's disrespectful.
That's true. Well, I'll join you in your disrespect, but none is intended. The trigger here is something that Judge Susswine says correctly is analytically different. At the beginning, when he's wrestling with the problem of how to deal with clearly indicated, he says, well, the concept of passion provocation, the concept of self-defense is an absolute defense. Passion provocation is a more limited kind of mitigation. It's something different. Why are we introducing into the analysis that judges are doing anyway a trigger that has nothing conceptually to do with what it is they're supposed to decide, which is whether to charge passion provocation? And it is not as though it's unusual. By the way, the scientists tell us, right, that coincidence is not causation. Of course cases will come up in which there's been passion provocation and there's a dispute below about whether or not, murder or self-defense, and a dispute about whether passion provocation should be charged. That's going to happen from now until the end of time. And by the way, as you look at Caron, and it's important to look at Caron and Judge Albin's opinion, even in the what he claims is an invited error case, he didn't say that was an instance where the appellate court should ignore the issue. Because the truth is, if even it should rise to this court, and there should be a case where the record shows that passion provocation was clearly indicated, and maybe the trial court and the appellate division missed it, that's not a reason not to deal with it. And the role of defense counsel is really important. I want to make it clear that this is not a party line issue where defense lawyers say, we're here, we're important, and what we say goes. But it's important to remember that Justice Wilentz, in Choice, was already reminding us that Powell was dictum, and that Powell didn't say disregard the strategic arguments of defense counsel, but to put them in perspective. So even where the issue is considered, the strategic view of defense counsel should be considered. In this case below, to answer your question, Chief Justice, I think it's fair to say the comments of defense counsel can't be completely interpreted. It's metaphysics to say, did he already know the judge was going to charge aggravated manslaughter, or did he learn it 30 seconds later? But clearly, if he starts out by saying, I think all or nothing gives this defendant the best chance of acquittal, it seems to me in that mix is the fact that the judge is going to charge a lesser included. So he's no longer in an all or nothing situation. The record is not clear, and I think it's the frustration with that lack of clarity in the record that caused Judge Susswine to come up with this plan. It just isn't a plan that is necessary or helpful. And I think to the extent that it suggests, even the very language of it suggests the last phrase, regardless of whether that instruction was requested by either party. I mean, that's the correct language. Well, it's not really regardless. It's after due consideration for whether each party, the state or defense, is requested and what their reasons are. And even if they're strategic reasons, they should be carefully considered.
Your reading of the comment goes to the point that you made earlier, that we're likely to continue to see appeals in these matters regardless.
Yes. There's no way around it. And you should. Respectfully, more the appellate division than this court, but there are going to be instances where trial judges aren't perfect. And in the context of making a judgment that involves a nuanced assessment, I mean, Caron is an interesting case because Caron, which is the case from which all this bad language comes, strategic maneuvering, don't ask, don't charge, which is imported by Judge Susswine into this opinion, which is one of the things that troubles ACDL. There seems to be the specter here of party line action that the trial lawyers, because this appears to be where my colleagues, the county agrees with me four square, the state is a little more gossamer, but they seem to be agreeing that this bright line rule isn't necessary. We're not here because we don't want our prerogatives limited. They have a duty to seek justice at all times, and we have a client for whom we should advocate. And it seems to me those things should be carefully considered. And in Karen, what's interesting is the case was reversed, remember, in terms of some evidence that was excluded by the trial judge improperly, as it turned out. But it was a rape shield law and a big issue concerning the relationship of the rape shield law to the constitutional prerogatives of a defendant to defend himself. And the question about whether flirtatious language should come in. And really, the question of invited error, I wouldn't say it was an afterthought. Justice Albin, who was a once and future defense lawyer, spanked his colleagues thoroughly for, at the last minute, saying, after the charge conference, I'm going to take a crapshoot. I don't want lesser included. But that trial judge had to judge a lot of things, including whether other evidence that bore on the question of lesser included should come in. The trial judge is burdened with a great many tasks during the course of the charge conference, and only one of them is an element analysis. He's going to look, and she is going to look at lesser included. That's their principal job. But they also have many other legal issues to manage at that point. To impose a rule that is logically flawed on that process, and also, by the way, that sort of suggests don't pay attention to what the state and the defense are saying, because they're partisans and they don't really have the interests of justice at heart, which is not really true. And Justice Wilentz was very clear in choice in saying that's not the rule. Their strategic interests are to be considered very carefully. Now, as judge, and in fact, it's the fact that he talked about complexity. These are complex decisions that have been made. Why make it more complex with a test we don't need? So I think that while I'm sure Judge Susswine was well-intentioned, I think this test will do nothing but mischief. It is of no assistance in any area where assistance is required. And it seems to me that it doesn't advance the ball. And in fact, it distracts us, the trial judge, from the true question was, do the facts clearly indicate the presence of evidence that warrants this charge, not is some unrelated concept. Now, the concept of imperfect self-defense is interesting. One could say logically, if a rule was bruited that perhaps where you charge self-defense, you should consider imperfect self-defense, if that was still permissible in New Jersey, there might be some logic to that. But even there, the need for it doesn't arise unless we're aware that there is either empirically demonstrated, which is not here, because Judge Susswine's listing of passion provocation cases is not empirical evidence, and the public defender didn't have any. So it seems to us that this is a bad rule, does mischief, runs afoul of Justice Wilentz's opinion in choice, and also doesn't do proper regard to the role of counsel, who have to play an important role. There's also some nuanced questions that I thought about, speaking of even non-brilliant minds can do mischief. We have a high standard for 3.3. So the judge is wrestling, and he says to the state, your duty is to do justice. Even though you say you don't want to charge, go out and give me a brief on why I should charge it. Defense counsel, you have a duty under 3.385 to be very clear. You tell me the same. I mean, I'm not saying that those things wouldn't be done, but what is it that we're asking? The judge has to make an assessment, ask for the honest argument of counsel, and then do the best he or she can to make an appropriate ruling. In this case, it is troublesome to me that we have different aspects. The appellate division found a lack of adequate provocation. I've heard a number of questions here about actual cooling off or cooling off time, the objective and subjective aspects. The fact that there are so many differences of opinion as to where there is a flaw in the clearly indicated analysis is interesting here. I think also, here's a man, the victim, who terrorized his family, and the defendant knew it. And on that day, his sister-in-law calls out for help because this man has assaulted somebody else. And at some time thereafter, there is a confrontation between a man carrying a potentially lethal weapon, because he had HIV and he is a drug user, and the defendant who has a weapon, who says he was afraid, whose wife says he was afraid. Now, to me, that's clearly indicated. And all the other disputes that have been arisen about the nuances of this are credibility issues for a jury. So I just wanted to be clear that while we disagree very strongly with our brethren at the Public Defender's Office, which is rare, on the question of this test, on the issue of Mr. Canfield, we think the appellate division did the right thing in looking at the facts, but did an analysis that was inaccurate. I think that there's so much here, I just want to take a quick look to see what it is that I will think of when I sit down. I said I should have said that.
There's really no dispute that the court, both courts, all three courts potentially, look at the facts.
Oh, they did. They did the correct.
And they did that. That's not really before.
Structurally, they did. And that's the point. The test proposed by Judge Susswine takes them away from the facts as a threshold matter. But within the framework of that, we think that they did the facts wrong. I mean, they've just missed the clearly indicated instance of passion provocation being warranted as charged to the jury.
In terms of process, you have no dispute with what the appellate division did, but you disagree with their
analysis. I disagree with the result. And I also think, Chief Justice, I respectfully think you've overinterpreted what counsel was saying, given the fact that he says all or nothing.
You're reading into my question the answer. So
that's what I'm supposed to do that. What else do I have? I have no goat entrails or Ouija board. So thank
you. We've already covered that, I think. Is there anything your notes point you to that you want to raise?
Well, I have another 4 hours, but I think I've said all that to be helpful.
We'll schedule that later.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Magan.
Thank you.
Certainly, if the court has any questions of the state with respect to the actual findings in this case, with respect to passion and provocation, the state would certainly address those concerns of the court. But the state would primarily rely upon its brief, and interestingly, in this case, rely upon the appellate division's findings without any reliance or findings from the trial court, where the appellate division's instance was able to clearly find that there was no passion provocation in this case. Addressing the procedural rule that has been suggested by the appellate division in this instance, the state would actually like to address first and work back to the nature of the rule, but the standard of appellate review, I think that's been raised by this court to my adversary, which is, what would that standard of review be and how would it play out in this instance and what's necessary? The one concern the state has with the appellate division's opinion in this case is the language that it's used to support or describe the rule that it is suggesting. It is saying only after careful, explicit, specific fact findings should the court then determine whether passion provocation is necessary. That lends itself to rational basis. Unless it jumps off the page, it should not be charged under the clearly indicated standard. Explicit, careful is not the same as jumping off the page. For appellate review purposes, factual findings from the trial court is entirely unnecessary because, especially when it comes to passion provocation, it is an entirely objective standard. There is nothing subjective that the appellate division needs from the trial court to make specific findings on appellate review. Credibility is not an issue. However we want to look at the weight of the evidence, I know there was some discussion in the appellate division opinion about, is it in the light most favorable, or do we follow State versus Powell? Really, it's a distinction without a difference in the sense of you're just looking at the existence of the evidence, not its worth. So on appeal for the appellate division, it is an entirely objective standard, which devoids the need for any type of factual findings from the trial court. The appellate division is simply tasked looking at the record objectively through the lens of the clearly indicated standard to determine whether error was committed below. In turn, that would then apply if there's been silence from defense, the plain error standard. So the standard of review on appeal would be the plain error standard. We're not talking about abuse of discretion because in this instance, when it comes to lesser included offenses, the trial court is not vested with discretion. Rather, it's obligatory. And that obligation is defined statutorily by 2C:1-8, and more in particular, by the action or inaction of defense counsel at trial or the defendant at trial. If the defendant requests the charge, then the rational basis standard applies. And in that instance, the trial court's obligation is to thoroughly examine the record to make a determination whether or not evidence exists to rationally support that charge. If defendant remains silent and does not make that request or objects to that lesser included offense, then the obligation on the trial court is to only determine whether it's clearly indicated on the record. They are not to meticulously sift through the record. They are not to scour the statutes, but rather simply look to see if it jumps off the page. That is it. So there is no discretion. And again, for appellate review, it's an entirely objective standard. So there is absolutely no need for specific findings from the trial court, let alone careful and explicit findings, for the appellate division to be in an appropriate position. Yes, John.
Oh, no. Finish your sentence, please.
No, to be in that position to make findings. I don't think the appellate division, contrary to this opinion, needs those findings from the trial court to be in a position.
Let's take a broader view, not just about passion provocation, but other arguments frequently made on appeal by appellate counsel who, you know, scour the record, and they frequently identify a charge that wasn't given and should have been all the time. So from a housekeeping perspective, what's the harm in having something else on the list so that, you know, we don't get, maybe we don't have a spate of reversals on this particular issue, but I will submit in the appellate division, there's lots of briefs that always frequently point out there's something that should have been charged, wasn't asked for, nobody talked about it. So what's the harm in the housekeeping aspect of this?
In this instance, the housekeeping perspective of it was actually going to be creating these problems, because now there's actually going to be a greater question on appeal for the appellate division. It will be, well, what standard did the trial court apply here? Did the trial court apply a rational basis standard when it decided not to charge, or did it apply a clearly indicated standard? Because on appeal, the appellate division needs to make a determination as to what occurred at the trial level with respect to the standard of review, and whether there was a request by defense counsel or an objection by defense counsel or silence. So if the trial courts are now being told by this rule to engage in this colloquy, well, it begs the question then, at what point does the defense express their dislike, their concerns, their acquiesce? If the defense counsel acquiesces, is that them asking for the charge? Is that rational basis?
And we have the potential for the fluid situation where the charge starts out as the standards starts out as clearly indicated, but in the colloquy with the defense counsel, there's some level of acquiescence, which might be ambiguous. At times it is. And then it becomes rational basis because it's sort of being semi-requested at that point, right?
Correct. So in that instance, now on appellate review, we're going to be struggling with what obligation there was at that point before the trial court for the appellate division then be able to determine its review of error in that instance, if there's an argument of error. So that is why, again, we have this obligatory nature as to lesser included, and that silence by the defendant is considered action. It's not simply considered inaction, because it's, if the defendant wanted that charge, they would have requested it and they didn't. So if they remain silent, that's the same as objecting to it, because that will precipitate the clearly indicated standard. So really, silence by the defendant in this instance isn't so much of inaction, it's action along with the same nature of an objection at that point. So again, it would muddy the waters on appellate review for the appellate, and that is the state's position. With respect to the other aspect of this rule, the concern that the state has is it is contrary to this court's jurisprudence and this court's findings as recently as Funderburg with respect to that obligation and the burden on the trial court. In Funderburg, which was a clearly indicated standard, this court specifically said, we are reaffirming our position that there is no duty in a clearly indicated matter case. There is no duty on the trial court to meticulously sift through the record, to scour the statutes, to make a determination unless and but for the evidence jumps off the page. This court even went further in Funderburg to specifically say to do so would be overly burdensome, and we declined to put that burden on the trial court. This procedural rule puts that burden on the trial court. It is contrary to this court's jurisprudence in Funderburg.
How do you think the clearly indicated standard differs, if it does, from the normal plain error review standard that would apply to an error raised for the first time on appeal, which this is?
I think the two standards actually work hand in hand with respect to, first, it's a two-step process, essentially, that first, the appellate division must determine was there error or not. In that sense, the appellate division, for the clearly indicated standard, has to conduct an objective review of the evidence at trial to make a determination, was it error under the clearly indicated standard not to charge the lesser included offense, whether a counsel objected or whether there was silence. Then, and only then, if the court were to determine it was error not to charge the lesser included offense of passion provocation under the clearly indicated standard, then the appellate division would engage in the plain error standard of review to determine whether that error was clearly capable of producing an unjust result in that case. So in essence, it'd be a two-step process with those standards of review.
Thank you.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Magan?
Just one simple thing, Your Honors. With respect to, in the end, with the appellate division's findings and their rule, they suggest that the model criminal jury committee should look into a footnote. And I believe my adversary actually even referenced this footnote. When you look to the self-defense charge, there is actually a footnote now. It's under the premise of imperfect self-defense, but really all imperfect self-defense is a notion as to the elemental natures of murder and does it lend itself to Agman or Passion Prof? And in the appellate division's opinion, they actually have the language that is contained in that footnote, footnote one, which is, if you have an instance where a defendant has the honest belief or reasonable belief that there was the duty for force, but it's an honest and unreasonable use of force, i.e. deadly force, then the court should consider charging passion provocation. So essentially what the appellate division is suggesting, or the concern that the appellate division or that the trial court are at least aware, that awareness is brought forth in footnote one of the self-defense charge.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Lunder.
May it please the court. The Attorney General is asking this court to adopt the appellate division's procedural rule, perhaps modified, but as a matter of best practice rather than a bright line rule. And really what it comes down to, after hearing the arguments, is that it's not the onus on the, or what we're asking for is not for the trial judge to have a new burden to create this record, but to specifically ask counsel and have defense counsel make that record, because we do see this come up for the first time on appeal, and then the appellate court is, appellate division is tasked with this incomplete record and making a decision. And the opinion below cites a dozen cases where this has come up in unpublished opinions, where self-defense is raised, and then for the first time on appeal, the defense counsel is asking for passion provocation. And so we believe that this best practice of asking counsel what charges, specifically if self-defense is raised, do you want passion provocation, and getting an answer will prevent gamesmanship and also create a more fulsome record for appellate review. But ultimately, we agree with the state that the existing rubric of how...
Counsel, but isn't it correct that what the appellate division is suggesting is that the court make these findings, specific findings on the record, whether to instruct the jury on the lesser included offense? It's not just asking the parties a question, it's making these findings. So there is a burden on the trial court. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, that's in the appellate division opinion, which is our position is that that should be modified slightly to ask the question and have defense counsel make the record, and then the appellate court will have a better record for appellate review, just because this does come up a good bit for the first time on appeal. But if defense counsel isn't asking for the court, for the charge, if he doesn't say specifically, yes, we'd like passion provocation, then the standard of review on appeal should be that whether it was clearly indicated. It should not, this conversation should not invoke the rational basis test merely because it is discussed. It should be based on the defense.
I want to go back to your earlier comment, but please finish your sentence.
How
will it create a better record? It will flesh out what counsel wanted, but how will it create a better record in terms of analyzing either rational basis or clearly indicated on review? Arguments of counsel without the benefit of transcript can't do that, or can they?
Well, sure. The defense counsel can request a charge based on his theory of the case and his strategy all along, and then put reasons on the record of, yes, I want, puts him to the question of, yes, we want this charge, or no, we do not, so that when it comes up for the first time on appeal, there's a record made.
So that's the aspect in which you're suggesting the record will be clearer, what it is that defense counsel did or didn't want.
Correct. But this is simply a new procedural mechanism, a housekeeping matter, as Judge Sabatino suggested. It should not alter the existing standard of review that we have. And I would like to speak briefly about this case. As has been pointed out, everybody else went back inside. A reasonable person would have gone back inside and called the cops. And there's been the suggestion of, well, he broke into the house before. But the window was nailed shut. Defendant and the father-in-law nailed the window shut. So the way that he was getting in before, and it was kind of suggested in closing arguments, was perhaps that the ex-girlfriend had been allowing him in the house, letting him sneak in. That was foreclosed. Everybody else went inside. and they've called the police in the past. And the suggestion that the fistfight before was a provocation, well, that had ended. And also the facts suggest that the only injury was to Mr. DeFilippis's, I'm not saying his name correctly, his fists. So I'm not sure that that would create a reasonable provocation. And finally, I might add, we have had, if there are no other questions about this case, I would note that there are times in preparing for oral argument or writing a brief in cases where jury instructions are raised in general, it's sort of apparent from conversations with the trial counsel that there's been an charge conference that's made in chambers and then later on the record, but then some things don't quite make it on the record. So this case might make a good, create a good opportunity to remind trial courts that all charge conferences should be made fully on the record.
Sometimes you see, not here, but you see the judge saying, remember we talked about that on Tuesday? And you find yourself looking at the transcript and trying to figure out what Tuesday was.
Correct.
And there's nothing to be found there that sheds light on that later conversation. It is something that, it's a rushed process. Lawyers are trying to get it all done before the jury comes back from lunch or whatever it may be. And sometimes the records are not great.
Exactly.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard.
Thank
Mr. Markari, brief rebuttal.
Yes, just briefly, I wanted to be mindful of this court's letter regarding the focus and the argument, and I know that I did get into the facts somewhat. Mr. Canfield,
not stopping you from doing so. If you want to, go ahead.
Mr. Canfield did not ask the appellate division to make this procedural rule. He does not need this procedural rule to for this court to find that it was clearly indicated in this case. His interest in the procedural rule is because he believes it would have spurred the trial court in this case to recognize that this was clearly indicated, and I just want to ask this court that, you know, the facts here, I think, are the rare case where passion provocation was jumping off the page, both because of the fact that self-defense was charged, and as the state noted, you know, that passion provocation is something in the model jury charge. There's already a footnote prompting courts to consider because of the potential for imperfect self-defense, and just the facts here. I know that there was, you know, something made of the idea that Mr. Canfield could have called the police. Again, passion provocation does not depend on him having acted admirably or lawfully. It's still a criminal offense. But there was a lot of evidence that the family was at a breaking point. They'd had to screw their windows shut to keep this person out. This person they'd called the police on many times. This person who'd gotten into fights in the yard. There was a fear. There was testimony that Mr. Canfield was afraid and upset. And there was testimony that in the moments before he used this force, he was being advanced at by KP, who withdrew a needle. So I think all of that together jumps off the page, and I would just ask this court to apply the clearly indicated standard and find here that passion provocation should have been charged. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Courts in recess.